Welcome to the Well of Imagination, where tales from the depths of history and the far reaches of the unknown come to life. I'm your host, Alistair Hawthorne. Today we delve into the shadows of prehistory with a story from the legendary H.G. Wells, The Grizzly Folk. This tale, nestled within the pages of the Library of Short Stories, transports us to a time when humanity was not the only ruler of the earth. Join us as we explore the ancient world through Wells' eyes, where the boundaries between myth and reality blur, and the past whispers secrets about our very nature. Prepare to journey back to an era of primal fear and wonder, for the grisly folk awaits. Can these bones live? Could anything be more dead, more mute and inexpressive to the inexpert eye than the ochreous fragments of bone and the fractured lumps of flint that constitute the first traces of something human in the world? We see them in the museum cases, sorted out in accordance with principles we do not understand, labeled with strange names. Chelian, Mousterian, Solutrian and the like, taken mostly from the places Chel, La Moustier, Solutre and so forth, where the first specimens were found. Most of us stare through the glass at them, wonder vaguely for a moment at that half-savage, half-animal past of our race, and pass on. Primitive man, we say. Flint implements. The mammoth used to chase him. Few of us realize yet how much the subtle, indefatigable cross-examination of the scientific worker has been extracting from the evidence of these rusty and obstinate witnesses during the last few years. One of the most startling results of this recent work is the gradual realization that great quantities of these flint implements and some of the earlier fragments of bone that used to be ascribed to humanity are the vestiges of creatures. Very manlike in many respects, but not strictly speaking, belonging to the human species. Scientific men call these vanished races man, homo, just as they call lions and tigers, cats, felis. But there are the soundest reasons for believing that these earlier so-called men were not of our blood, not our ancestors, but a strange and vanished animal, like us, akin to us, but different from us, as the mammoth was like and akin to, and yet different from, the elephant. Flint and bone implements are found in deposits of very considerable antiquity. Some in our museums may be a million years old or more, but the traces of really human creatures, mentally and anatomically like ourselves, do not go back much earlier than 20 or 30,000 years ago. True men appeared in Europe then, and we do not know whence they came. These other tool-using, fire-making animals, the things that were like men and yet were not men, passed away before the faces of the true men. Scientific authorities already distinguish four species of these pseudo-men, and it is probable that we shall learn from time to time of other species. One strange breed made the implements called Chelian. These are chiefly soul-shaped blades of stone found in deposits of perhaps 300,000 or 400,000 years ago. Chelian implements are to be seen in any great museum. They are huge implements, four or five times as big as those made by any known race of true men, and they are not ill-made. Certainly some creature with an intelligent brain made them. Big, clumsy hands must have gripped and used these rocky chunks. But so far, only one small fragment of a skeleton of this age has been found, a very massive, chinless lower jawbone, with teeth rather more specialized than those of men today. We can only guess what strange foreshadowing of the human form once ate with that jaw and struck at its enemies with those big but not unhandy flint blades. It may have been a tremendous fellow, probably much bigger in the body than a man. It may have been able to take bears by the scruff and the saber-toothed lion by the throat. We do not know. We have just these great stone blades and that bit of a massive jaw and the liberty to wonder. Most fascinating riddle of all these riddles of the ages of ice and hardship, before the coming of the true men, is the riddle of the Mousterian men, because they were perhaps still living in the world when the true man came wandering into Europe. They lived much later than those unknown Chelian giants. They lived 30 or 40,000 years ago, a yesterday compared with the Chelian time. These Mousterians are also called Neanderthalers. Until quite recently, it was supposed that they were true men like ourselves. But now we begin to realize that they were different, so different that it is impossible that they can be very close relations of ours. They walked or shambled along with a peculiar slouch. They could not turn their heads up to the sky, and their teeth were very different from those of true men. One oddity about them is that in one or two points they were less like apes than we are. The dog tooth, the third tooth from the middle, which is so big in the gorilla, and which in man is pointed and still quite distinct from the other teeth, is not distinct at all in the Neanderthaler. He had a very even row of teeth, and his cheek teeth also were very unlike ours, and less like the apes than ours. He had more face and less brow than true men, but that is not because he had a lesser brain. His brain was as big as a modern man's, but it was different, bigger behind and smaller in front, so that probably he thought and behaved differently from us. Perhaps he had a better memory and less reasoning power than real men, or perhaps he had more nervous energy and less intelligence. He had no chin, and the way his jawbones come together below make it very doubtful if he could have used any such sounds in speech as we employ. Probably he did not talk at all. He could not hold a pin between his finger and thumb. The more we learn about this beast man, the stranger he becomes to us, and the less like the Australoid savage he was once supposed to be. And as we realize the want of any close relationship between this ugly, strong, ungainly man-like animal and mankind, the less likely it becomes that he had a naked skin and hair like ours, and the more probable that he was different, and perhaps bristly or hairy in some queer, inhuman fashion, like the hairy elephant and the woolly rhinoceros, who were his contemporaries. Like them, he lived in a bleak land on the edge of the snows and glaciers that were even then receding northward. Hairy or grizzly, with a big face like a mask, great brow ridges and no forehead, clutching an enormous flint, and running like a baboon with his head forward, and not like a man with his head up, he must have been a fearsome creature for our forefathers to come upon. Almost certainly they met, these grizzly men and the true men. The true man must have come into the habitat of the Neanderthaler, and the two must have met and fought. Some day we may come upon the evidences of this warfare. Western Europe, which is the only part of the world that has yet been searched with any thoroughness for the remains of early men, was slowly growing warmer age by age. The glaciers that had once covered half the continent were receding, and wide stretches of summer pasture and thin woods of pine and birch were spreading slowly over the once icy land. South Europe then was like northern Labrador today. A few hardy beasts held out amidst the snows, the bears hibernated. With the spring grass and foliage came great herds of reindeer, wild horses, mammoth, elephant, and rhinoceros, drifting northward from the slopes of the great warm valley that is now filled up with water, the Mediterranean Sea. It was in those days before the ocean waters broke into the Mediterranean that the swallows and a multitude of other birds acquired the habit of coming north, a habit that nowadays impels them to brave the passage of the perilous seas that flow over and hide the lost secrets of the ancient Mediterranean valleys. The grizzly men rejoiced at the return of life, came out of the caves in which they had lurked during the winter, and took their toll of the beasts. These grizzly men must have been almost solitary creatures. The winter food was too scanty for communities. A male may have gone with a female or so. Perhaps they parted in the winter and came together in the summer. When his sons grew big enough to annoy him, the grizzly man killed them or drove them off. If he killed them, he may have eaten them. If they escaped him, they may have returned to kill him. The grizzly folk may have had long unreasoning memories and very set purposes. The true men came into Europe. We know not whence, out of the south. When they appeared in Europe, their hands were as clever as ours. They could draw pictures we still admire. They could paint and carve. The implements they made were smaller than the Mousterian ones, far smaller than the Chellian, but better made and more various. They wore no clothes worth speaking of, but they painted themselves, and probably they talked. And they came in little bands. They were already more social than the Neanderthaler. They had laws and self-restraints. Their minds had travelled a long way along that path of adaptation and self-suppression, which has led to the intricate mind of man today, with its concealed wishes, its confusions and laughter, and the fantasies and reveries and dreams. They were already held together, these men, and kept in order by the strange limitations of taboo. They were still savages, very prone to violence and convulsive in their lusts and desires, but to the best of their poor ability, they obeyed laws and customs already immemorably ancient, and they feared the penalties of wrongdoing. We can understand something of what was going on in their minds, those of us who can remember the fears, desires, fancies, and superstitions of our childhood. Their moral struggles were ours, in cruder forms. They were our kind. But the grisly folk we cannot begin to understand. We cannot conceive in our different minds the strange ideas that chased one another through those queerly shaped brains. As well might we try to dream and feel as a gorilla dreams and feels. We can understand how the true men drifted northward from the lost lands of the Mediterranean Valley into the high Spanish valleys and the south and centre of France, and so on to what is now England, for there was no channel then between England and France, and eastward to the Rhineland, and over the broad wilderness which is now the North Sea and the German plain. They would leave the snowy wilderness of the Alps, far higher then and covered with great glaciers, away on their right. These people drifted northward, for the very good reason that their kind was multiplying and food diminishing. They would be oppressed by feuds and wars. They had no settled homes. They were accustomed to drift with the seasons. Every now and then some band would be pushed by hunger and fear a little farther northward into the unknown. We can imagine the appearance of a little group of these wanderers, our ancestors, coming over some grassy crest into these northern lands. The time would be late spring or early summer, and they would probably be following up some grazing beasts, a reindeer herd or horses. By a score of different means, our anthropologists have been able to reconstruct the particulars of the appearance and habits of these early pilgrim fathers of mankind. They would not be a very numerous band, because if they were, there would be no reason why they should have been driven northward out of their former roving grounds. Two or three older men of 30 or so, 8 or 10 women and girls with a few young children, a few lads between 14 and 20, might make up the whole community. They would be a brownish, brown-eyed people with wavy dark hair, the fairness of the European and the straight blue-black hair of the Chinaman had still to be evolved in the world. The older men would probably lead the band. The women and children would keep apart from the youths and men, fenced off by complex and definite taboos from any close companionship. The leaders would be tracking the herd they were following. Tracking was then the supreme accomplishment of mankind. By signs and traces that would be invisible to any modern civilized eye, they would be reading the story of the previous day's trek of the herd of sturdy little horses ahead of them. They would be so expert that they would go on from one faint sign to another with as little delay as a dog who follows a scent. The horses they were following were only a little way ahead, so the trackers read the signs. They were numerous, and nothing had alarmed them. They were grazing and moving only very slowly. There were no traces of wild dog or other enemies to stampede them. Some elephants were also going north, and twice our human tribe had crossed the spoor of woolly rhinoceros roaming westward. The tribe travelled light. They were mainly naked, but all of them were painted with white and black and red and yellow ochre. At this distance of time, it is difficult to see whether they were tattooed. Probably they were not. The babies and small children were carried by the women on their backs in slings or bags made of animal skins, and perhaps some or all of them wore mantles and loin bands of skin and had pouches and belts of leather. The men had stone-pointed spears and carried sharpened flints in their hands. There was no old man who was lord and master and father of this particular crowd. Weeks ago, the old man had been charged and trampled to a jelly by a great bull in the swamp far away. Then two of the girls had been waylaid and carried off by the young men of another larger tribe. It was because of these losses that this remnant was now seeking new hunting grounds. The landscape that spread before the eyes of this little band as they crested the hill was a bleaker, more desolate and altogether unkempt version of the landscape of Western Europe today. About them was a grassy down athwart, which a peewit flew with its melancholy cry. Before them stretched a great valley ridged with transverse purple hills over which the April cloud shadows chased one another. Pine woods and black heather showed where these hills became sandy, and the valleys were full of brown brushwood, and down their undrained troughs ran a bright green band of peaty swamps and long pools of weedy water. In the valley thickets, many beasts lurked unseen, and where the winding streams had cut into the soil, there were cliffs and caves. Far away along the northern slopes of the ridge that were now revealed, the wild ponies were to be seen grazing. At a sign from the two leaders, the little straggle of menfolk halted, and a woman who had been chattering in subdued tones to a little girl became silent. The brothers surveyed the wide prospect earnestly. "Ugh!" said one abruptly and pointed. "Ugh!" cried his brother. The eyes of the whole tribe swung round to the pointing finger. The group became one rigid stare. Every soul of them stood still. Astonishment had turned them into a tense group of statuettes. Far away down the slope, with his body in profile and his head turned towards them, frozen by an equal amazement, stood a hunched grey figure, bigger but shorter than a man. He had been creeping up behind a fold in the ground to peer at the ponies, and suddenly he had turned his eyes and seen the tribe. His head projected like a baboon's. In his hand he carried what seemed to the menfolk a great rock. For a little while this animal scrutiny held discoverers and discovered motionless. Then some of the women and children began to stir and line out to see the strange creature better. "Man," said an old crone of 40. "Man." At the movement of the women, the grisly man turned, ran clumsily for a score of yards or so towards a thicket of birch and budding thorn. Then he halted again for a moment to look at the newcomers, waved an arm strangely, and then dashed into cover. The shadows of the thicket swallowed him up, and by hiding him seemed to make him enormous. It identified itself with him, and watched them with his eyes. Its tree stems became long, silvery limbs, and a fallen trunk crouched and stared. It was still early in the morning, and the leaders of the tribe had hoped to come up with the wild ponies as the day advanced and perhaps cut one off and drive it into difficulties among the bushes and swampy places below, and wound it and follow it up and kill it. Then they would have made a feast, and somewhere down in the valley they would have found water and dry bracken for litter and a fire before night. It had seemed a pleasant and hopeful morning to them until this moment. Now they were disconcerted. This grey figure was as if the sunny morning had suddenly made a horrible and inexplicable grimace. The whole expedition stood gazing for a time, and then the two leaders exchanged a few words. "Wah," the elder pointed. Click, his brother, nodded his head. They would go on, but instead of slanting down the slopes towards the thickets, they would keep round the ridge. "Come," said War, and the little band began to move again. But now it marched in silence. When presently a little boy began a question, his mother silenced him by a threat. Everybody kept glancing at the thickets below. Presently a girl cried out sharply and pointed. All started and stopped short. There was the grisly thing again. It was running across an open space, running almost on all fours in joltering leaps. It was hunchbacked and very big and low, a grey, hairy, wolf-like monster. At times its long arms nearly touched the ground. It was nearer than it had been before. It vanished amidst the bushes again. It seemed to throw itself down among some red dead bracken. War and Click took counsel. A mile away was the head of the valley where the thickets had their beginning. Beyond stretched the Woldy Hills, bare of cover. The horses were grazing up towards the sun, and away to the north, the backs of a herd of woolly rhinoceros were now visible on a crest, just the ridges of their backs showing like a string of black beads. If the tribe struck across those grassy spaces, then the lurking prowler would have either to stay behind or come into the open. If he came into the open, the dozen youths and men of the tribe would know how to deal with him. So they struck across the grass. The little band worked round to the head of the valley, and there the menfolk stayed at the crest while the women and children pushed on ahead across the open. For a time, the watchers remained motionless, and then war was moved to gestures of defiance. Click was not to be outdone. There were shouts at the hidden watcher, and then one lad, who was something of a clown, after certain grimaces and unpleasant gestures, obliged with an excellent imitation of the grey thing's lumbering run. At that, scare gave place to hilarity. In those days, laughter was a social embrace. Men could laugh, but there was no laughter in the grisly pre-man who watched and wondered in the shadow. He marvelled. The men rolled about and guffawed and slapped their thighs in one another. Tears ran down their faces. Never a sign came from the thickets. "Yaha," said the menfolk. "Yaha, bzz, yaha, ya." They forgot altogether how frightened they had been. And when War thought the women and children had gone on a sufficient distance, he gave the word for the men to follow them. In some such fashion, it was that men, our ancestors, had their first glimpse of the pre-men of the wilderness of Western Europe. The two breeds were soon to come to closer quarters. The newcomers were pushing their way into the country of these grisly men. Presently came other glimpses of lurking semi-human shapes and grey forms that ran in the twilight. In the morning, Click found long, narrow footprints round the camp. Then one day, one of the children, eating those little green thorn buds that rustic English children speak of as bread and cheese, ventured too far from the others. There was a squeal and a scuffle and a thud, and something grey and hairy made off through the thickets carrying its victim, with War and three of the younger men in hot pursuit. They chased the enemy into a dark gully, very much overgrown. This time it was not a solitary Neanderthaler they had to deal with. Out of the bushes, a big male came at them to cover the retreat of his mate, and hurled a rock that bowled over the youth it hit like a ninepin, so that thereafter he limped always. But War, with his throwing spear, got the grey monster in the shoulder, and he halted snarling. No further sound came from the stolen child. The female showed herself for a moment up the gully, snarling, blood-stained and horrible, and the menfolk stood about afraid to continue their pursuit, and yet not caring to desist from it. One of them was already hobbling off with his hand to his knee. How did that first fight go? Perhaps it went against the men of our race. Perhaps the big Neanderthaler male, his mane and beard bristling horribly, came down the gully with a thunderous roar, with a great rock in either hand. We do not know whether he threw those big discs of flint, or whether he smote with them. Perhaps it was then that War was killed in the act of running away. Perhaps it was bleak disaster then for the little tribe. Short of two of its members, it presently made off over the hills as fast as it could go, keeping together for safety, and leaving the wounded youth far behind to limp along its tracks in lonely terror. Let us suppose that he got back to the tribe at last, after nightmare hours. Now that War had gone, Click would become old man, and he made the tribe camp that night, and build their fire on the high ridges among the heather, far away from the thickets in which the grisly folk might be lurking. The grisly folk thought we knew not how about the menfolk, and the men thought about the grisly folk in such ways as we can understand. They imagined how their enemies might act in this fashion or that, and schemed to circumvent them. It may have been Click who had the first dim idea of getting at the gorge in which the Neanderthalers had their lair from above. For as we have said, the Neanderthaler did not look up. Then the menfolk could roll a great rock upon him, or pelt him with burning brands, and set the dry bracken alight. One likes to think of a victory for the human side. This Click we have conjured up had run in panic from the first onset of the grisly male. But as he brooded by the fire that night, he heard again in imagination the cry of the lost girl, and he was filled with rage. In his sleep, the grisly male came to him, and Click fought in his dreams and started awake, stiff with fury. There was a fascination for him in that gorge in which War had been killed. He was compelled to go back and look again for the grisly beasts, to waylay them in their tracks, and watch them from an ambush. He perceived that the Neanderthalers could not climb as easily as the menfolk could climb, nor hear so quickly, nor dodge with the same unexpectedness. These grisly men were to be dealt with as the bears were dealt with, the bears before whom you run and scatter, and then come at again from behind. But one may doubt if the first human group to come into the grisly land was clever enough to solve the problems of the new warfare. Maybe they turned southward again to the gentler regions from which they had come, and were killed by or mingled with their own brethren again. Maybe they perished altogether in that new land of the grisly folk into which they had intruded. Yet the truth may be that they even held their own, and increased. If they died, there were others of their kind to follow them and achieve a better fate. That was the beginning of a nightmare age for the little children of the human tribe. They knew they were watched. Their steps were dogged. The legends of ogres and man-eating giants that haunt the childhood of the world may descend to us from those ancient days of fear. And for the Neanderthalers, it was the beginning of an incessant war that could end only in extermination. The Neanderthalers, albeit not so erect and tall as men, were the heavier, stronger creatures, but they were stupid, and they went alone, or in twos and threes. The menfolk were swifter, quicker-witted, and more social. When they fought in combination. They lined out and surrounded and pestered and pelted their antagonists from every side. They fought the men of that grisly race as dogs might fight a bear. They shouted to one another what each should do, and the Neanderthaler had no speech. He did not understand. They moved too quickly for him and fought too cunningly. Many and obstinate were the duels and battles these two sorts of men fought for this world in that bleak age of the windy steppes, 30 or 40,000 years ago. The two races were intolerable to each other. They both wanted the caves and the banks by the rivers where the big flints were got. They fought over the dead mammoths that had been bogged in the marshes, and over the reindeer stags that had been killed in the rutting season. When a human tribe found signs of the grisly folk near their cave and squatting place, they had perforce to track them down and kill them. Their own safety and the safety of their little ones was only to be secured by that killing. The Neanderthalers thought the little children of men fair game and pleasant eating. How long the grisly folk lived on in that chill world of pines and silver birch between the steppes and the glaciers, after the true menfolk came, we do not know. For ages they may have held out, growing more cunning and dangerous as they became rare. The true men hunted them down by their spoor and by their tracks, and watched for the smoke of their fires, and made food scarce for them. Great paladins arose in that forgotten world, men who stood forth and smote the grey man-beast face to face and slew him. They made long spears of wood, hardened by fire at the tips. They raised shields of skin against his mighty blows. They struck at him with stones on cords, and slung them at him with slings. And it was not simply men who withstood the grisly beast, but women. They stood over their children. They stood by their men against this eerie thing that was like and yet not like mankind. Unless the savants read all the signs awry, it was the women who were the makers of the larger tribes, into which human families were already growing in those ancient times. It was the woman's subtle, love-guided wits which protected her sons from the fierce anger of the old man, and taught them to avoid his jealousy and wrath, and persuaded him to tolerate them, and so have their help against the grisly enemy. It was woman, says Atkinson, in the beginning of things human, who taught the primary taboos, that a son must go aside out of the way of his stepmother and get himself a wife from another tribe, so as to keep the peace within the family. She came between the fratricides and was the first peacemaker. Human societies in their beginnings were her work, done against the greater solitariness, the lonely fierceness of the adult male. Through her, men learnt the primary cooperation of sonship and brotherhood. The grisly folk had not learnt even the rudest elements of cooperation, and mankind had already spelt out the alphabet of a unity that may someday comprehend the whole earth. The menfolk kept together by the dozen and by the score. By ones and twos and threes, therefore, the grisly folk were beset and slain until there were no more of them left in the world. Generation after generation, age after age, That long struggle for existence went on between these men, who were not quite men, and the men, our ancestors, who came out of the south into Western Europe. Thousands of fights and hunts, sudden murders and headlong escapes there were amidst the caves and thickets of that chill and windy world, between the last age of glaciers and our own warmer time. Until at length, the last poor grizzly was brought to bay and faced the spears of his pursuers in anger and despair. What leapings of the heart were there not throughout that long warfare? What moments of terror and triumph? What acts of devotion and desperate wonders of courage? And the strain of the victors was our strain. We are lineally identical with those sun-brown painted beings who ran and fought and helped one another. The blood in our veins glowed in those fights and chilled in those fears of the forgotten past. For it was forgotten. Except perhaps for some vague terrors in our dreaming life and for some lurking element of tradition in the legends and warnings of the nursery, it has gone altogether out of the memory of our race. But nothing is ever completely lost. 70 or 80 years ago, a few curious savants began to suspect that there were hidden memories in certain big chipped flints and scraps of bone they found in ancient gravels. Much more recently, others have begun to find hints of remote, strange experiences in the dreams and odd kinks in modern minds. By degrees, these dry bones begin to live again. This restoration of the past is one of the most astonishing adventures of the human mind. As humanity follows the gropings of scientific men among these ancient vestiges, it is like a man who turns over the yellow pages of some long-forgotten diary, some engagement book of his adolescence. His dead youth lives again. Once more the old excitements stir him. The old happiness returns. But the old passions that once burnt only warm him now, and the old fears and distresses signify nothing. A day may come when these recovered memories may grow as vivid as if we in our own persons had been there and shared the thrill and the fear of those primordial days. A day may come when the great beasts of the past will leap to life again in our imaginations, when we shall walk again in vanished scenes, stretch painted limbs we thought were dust, and feel again the sunshine of a million years ago. And so, we conclude our journey back to the dawn of humanity, with H.G. Wells' The Grizzly Folk. It's a tale that challenges us to look deep into our past and ponder the mysteries of our origins. As we leave the ancient world behind and return to the present, we carry with us the echoes of those long-lost stories, reminding us of the complex tapestry of human history. Thank you for joining me, Alistair Hawthorne, in the Well of Imagination. Until next time, keep the fires of curiosity burning and let your imagination roam free through the pages of history and beyond. Farewell, and may your path be ever illuminated by the light of discovery.